Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
You're listening to The Times. Go to thetimes.co.uk.
Your subscription to The Times and The Sunday Times now comes with access to every Barclays Premier League goal. Refresh your app, choose your team, accept notification, and you're away. All with our award-winning commentary, opinion, and insights. Every goal, every game, everywhere. The Times and the Sunday Times, now with goals.
Good evening. Thank you all for coming tonight. It's great to be here in the great city of Manchester, the great northwest of England. And I'm really excited because I often, on the game podcast, I often only get to hear Ollie's voice, whereas tonight I get to see Oliver Kay as well. And if you could join me in applauding, it's Oliver Kay, the chief football writer at The Times, or some title like that. Ollie, please come and join me up here on stage. Joining Ollie on the panel is our local man in this part of the country. You may be familiar with him. If you're not, feel free to walk up to him afterwards and ask him all sorts of highly detailed questions about Wigan's reserve team. He especially likes that. It's James Ducker. And finally, in these situations, you normally say he doesn't need any introductions. I'd be very disappointed if you didn't know who this gentleman was. Let me just say that I believe only one person in the history of the Premier League, which I know only goes back 20 years, but this is when it got really, really good, or so they tell me, only one person has ever scored more Premier League goals than he has. It's Andy Cole. Can we have some applause, please, for a treble winner? Thank you. Okay, now, you guys may have heard the podcast. We're going to be a little bit looser tonight, but as our producer, Chris Skinner, said, we still want to maintain a little bit of discipline. So we're going to look locally at Manchester United and City in our first half of this podcast. Just so I get a sense, how many, can I have a show of hands of who here is not a City or a Manchester United supporter? Okay, all right, this is a diverse crowd. We thought you'd all be red or blue, but should we change the agenda? Do we not want to talk about small clubs? Like, all right, can we have a show of hands, United supporters? All right, I sense City might be in the minority here. City fans? Okay, all three of you, all right. Okay, see, like, Andy smiling, grinning. I'm sorry? Exactly. They're more that sort of genre. But so let's start out with the better represented, better supported team here tonight, Manchester United. So many people have weighed in on this. There's obviously been a transition this year from a guy who was there for some time. Andy, I'm going to give you a hypothetical question. If you were still playing, David Moyes had come to you, say, in preseason training, and he'd come to you and he'd said, Andy, you're still playing, you're one of my players, what are you expecting of me this year? What would you have said to him?
As a player?
Yeah, assuming he was still your boss. But he wanted an honest answer.
To be fair, I would be very surprised if I was still playing and a manager asked me what he's expected of me, because I know I'm expecting myself, first and foremost.
No, no, what you're expecting of him?
Well, it's not for you to question the manager, is it?
It's, what, 10 years under Sir Alex? Is
that... Yeah, well, exactly. You know, you never question him. As a manager, regardless what football team is, a new manager comes in, you know what to expect from a new manager, and as a manager, he knows what to expect from his players. But it's just it's a difficult scenario, him coming in to Manchester United to replace Alex Ferguson after 26 years. Tough period. You know, that should have come with a warning hazard. Dangerous. You know? And it was going to be very, very tough for whoever come in to replace him. David Moyes is coming and he's found it very, very tough, because Manchester United to Everton, not being disrespectful, the comparison is zero, because you have one team who been dominated the Premiership for what, 20 years? Virtually 20 years. They've had a couple of blips when they've not won the Championship, and a team that has done well to finish mid-table or in the top half of the table, so it's very, very tough for them.
Ollie, I'm going to throw the same question to you. If David Moyes had come to you and said, what do you expect from me this season?
As a journalist, or
well, as somebody who knows football, if he'd come to you and says, "What do you think will happen to me this season? How do you think I'm going to handle crises? How I'm going to handle situations, and where do you think I will finish?" What would you have told him?
Well, I would be surprised and unnerved if a manager was asking that. Mm. But I think it's relevant in this case, because I think Moyes has gone there rather than feeling I'm going to be my own man. I think he's gone in there with preconceptions or concerns about having to fit a certain mould. You're stepping into the shoes of a legend, a guy who's been there 26 years, who's won everything, and you've been handpicked by him. He's still on the board. You've got all these players even Ryan Giggs, who's been playing 22 years, what is it, 23 years in the first team. He's only ever been used to one manager, and it must be a real culture shock for them to be adjusting to another manager. So I can understand why Moyes would think, how do I have to be? What do they want me to be? But I don't think that approach is particularly working. I think if he's going to make it work, which I think it's reaching a stage where it probably is, I think he's got to have a real crack at being his own man and not worry about treading on eggshells, not worrying about putting people's noses out of joint, not worry about offending some of the senior players who perhaps haven't pulled their weight this season. And he needs to make his imprint on that team, because right now his imprint just isn't there.
James, on the back of what Ollie's saying, I kind of get the sense that, you know, in football, managers come and go, situations change, but we kind of generally get the same archetypes or the same stories over and over again. Here, there's no blueprint, because there's never been anybody like Sir Alex Ferguson. There may never be again. So it's not as if David Moyes can look at other situations and say, all right, well, this guy did that. This is how you go and you replace somebody after 26 years. I mean, do you get the sense that he went into it flying blind and he could do, all he could do is basically the best he can, but there was no right way to relate yourself to the players, no right way to pick your coaching staff. Obviously, some people have opined that maybe it was a mistake to change a lot of the backroom staff and so on. Is that what he was thrown into?
I don't agree with that necessarily. I think if you are a top elite manager, you have sort of complete conviction in your beliefs, and it doesn't really matter what has sort of preceded you. You know, you will believe that you can do things the right way. I think my concern with David Moyes, and this sort of goes back to, you know, his time at Everton, is that a top manager, and it doesn't necessarily have to be in football, it can be in any sort of walk of life. I'd say two of the key sort of characteristics that they have are an extreme decisiveness, an absolute sort of conviction in their beliefs, and the second is that they are sort of risk takers, that they are that they are gamblers.
I sense you're about to tell me that David Moyes doesn't fit that mould.
Well, obviously the obvious comparison is Jose Mourinho because he was heavily discussed. David Gill and Sir Bobby Charlton were as determined not to have him as Sir Alex Ferguson, but a lot of obviously people saw the game, the Chelsea game on Monday night, and complete sort of conviction in attitude and in method and application. I think one of the great examples and a great contrast with Moyes is Mourinho went into Chelsea with a preconceived idea to jettison Juan Mata, who was the club's player of the year in the previous two seasons. Now, whatever the rights and wrongs of that decision, the absolute sort of conviction to get rid of a player of that quality, I mean, just sort of smacks of such sheer belief. And in a sort of a perverse way, the players must look at that and think, you know, wow. Whereas the contrast, I would say, with Moyes is that he's deferred a lot. I think there's a lot to recommend him, but I sometimes worry this season that he's wavered too much, that he's not followed his gut on things, and that he's trying to sort of please, he's trying to sort of, you know, look to other people. And I remember on the pre-season tour to Asia and Australia, he did say to us, I'm going to have to take my lead from players in the dressing room. You know, some of them have won 10, 12 Premier League titles. I've not won anything. I'm going to have to learn a lot from them. And I just sort of sense there was a wavering of sort of belief in the early start, and he has made some very good decisions. He has made some very decisive decisions, but there's been a lot there. There seems to be a lot of muddled thinking.
Andy, I want to get your take on it, but what James just said, because it's interesting. Because I mean, even if you've not been a footballer, I mean, most of us, I assume, have bosses, and sometimes your boss comes to you and says, "What do you think?" In this case, James outlined Moyes saying publicly, you know, I'll have to take my lead from some of the veteran players here. You obviously haven't just worked for Sir Alex. I think you get the impression that he wasn't the kind of guy who may necessarily went and did that. You've worked with other managers. Mm-hmm. As a player, how do you handle it? Have you been in those situations where people have wanted your input because ultimately you're there on the front lines? Would you think maybe slightly less of somebody if they came to you?
No, not at all. I think when you get to that senior statesman, i.e. you're getting on in age and you've been at Manchester United for numerous amount of years, a new manager comes in, a new player comes in, you look into those senior players, you know, you look into them to try and gain from their experience how do you go about certain things being at Manchester United. Manchester United is a huge football club, and we're not just talking on the green grass of Old Trafford, we're talking about everything about the football club. So you're always looking to someone to try and explain certain things, to try and make you a better person, try and make you get there to win as many games as possible. So you will always draw upon the experience from your squad, and that's what it's all about.
It's an interesting point. I'm curious now, on the back of what James or what Ollie said, and James actually, about Mourinho. Can I get a show of hands from the United fans here? Who here thinks that United would have made a better decision by appointing Jose Mourinho instead of David Moyes? Who does not? All right, and this is a strictly controlled group of just United fans. I think it's fair to say it's edging towards Mourinho not the right choice. Does it surprise you, Ollie?
Well, for the benefit of those listening, I thought it's probably about half and half.
I think it was more like 52-48.
Okay.
Well, if I use the term edging.
Fairly near.
50. Okay, but it's not the unanimous Mourinho loving. You read some national media, you get the impression that this guy walks on water and only he can achieve certain things when, you know.
Yeah. I mean, we had years and years and years to think about what would happen when Fergie left and who would the ideal choice be. I wrote on a few occasions when it was relevant, when Mourinho was sort of flirting a bit with United and fluttering his eyebrows and you know, talking about how a big job needs a big main, you know, big name, big manager, and how it would take a special manager to follow in Ferguson's shoes. And I was always of the view that Mourinho wouldn't be right for United. I have little doubt that Mourinho would have made a better start than Moyes has done, but I mean, we can never really say he would have been the right man. I think Mourinho is somebody who goes in to a club, makes a fantastic impact, and probably that lasts about 2 years. Mm-hmm. If you look at Chelsea, you look at Inter, you look at Real Madrid, Porto slightly different because he left on a real high with them. But I think a lot of United's philosophy, maybe this is really living in the past, but you look at United's philosophy and it's Busby, Ferguson, you look at it's about youth, it's about mm-hmm. a certain daredevil style, and that is what I associate with United. And you could legitimately say, well, is that really David Moyes? I don't know, but I don't think that's the Mourinho style. And for various reasons, I didn't think Mourinho was right for United. But to be honest, I didn't think anybody was right for United. I think it would have suited United for Ferguson to stay there forever and ever and ever. And if they could sort of cryogenically frozen him when the day came. But it is very difficult to think of anybody who would have gone in and avoided a sort of post-Ferguson drop-off.
Now, one area which I think was really affected was the fact that it wasn't just Sir Alex leaving, it was also the chief executive, David Gill, leaving at the
kit man as well, Albert Morgan, the kit man.
The kit man, Albert, yes. I'm sure Andy will regale us with stories of Albert afterwards. But so you've had these three key individuals leave the club at the same time, and one of the things that Moyes got absolutely slaughtered for in the summer, along with Ed Woodward, was their transfer policy, the fact that the hemming and hawing, needlessly spending £4 million more for Fellaini. Some people thought Fellaini himself. I want to throw this to you, James, because one of the stories I was told by people who deal with United, and I want to see to what degree it's verifiable, is that Woodward, in part, got the job to replace Gill because he said they would be doing much more dealing directly with clubs. They would be cutting out certain middlemen who were sort of in and around United before and who helped deliver players. One obvious middleman might have come along with Mourinho as part of the furniture. Is that the case, and is that part of the reason why they seem to have so much trouble signing players in the summer? And even the Mata deal, the way it was all sort of conducted, just with things written down on paper rather than face-to-face?
Yeah, I think, in the final years of the sort of Ferguson Gill regime, they'd really worked towards creating a situation where they could cut out as many agents and as many middlemen as possible. And they pulled the plug. They canned so many deals because they weren't... the Sami Nasri one was a good example. His agents, and there was about three of them, wanted about £4.5 million to sort of complete the deal, and Ferguson and Gill just vetoed that because they just felt it wasn't what they were prepared to do. And some would argue that was the right thing to do. Others would argue it's a sort of an unfortunate... a necessary evil in modern day football, and I think Ed Woodward, he's a smart sort of bullish character. I think he came in hoping to sort of continue in that vein, but with his eyes wide open, and to a degree he sort of did that. I think at the start of this summer they had a deal in all in place, all agreed, for Thiago Alcantara to join from Barcelona. That had all been sort of set up by the previous regime. Moyes felt that he wanted longer to look at him and said not for now, and 4 weeks later he signed for Bayern Munich. So I think for a lot of people at the club, that they felt that sort of put them on the back foot from the start, and they never really recovered. And as the summer sort of progressed, it did become more obvious that Ed Woodward was consulting an ever widening sort of degree of people rather than sort of the close knit circle that they'd use. But I don't know if you can criticise him for that for too much. I mean, Gill had time to sort of grow into that role under Ferguson. He'd had ten years in the job. It was quite a unique sort of privileged situation that they almost had. And I just think it, as hard as it was for David Moyes starting, it was equally as hard for Ed Woodward. And don't get me wrong, I mean, some of the decisions in the summer were strange. I mean, there was something like a 3-week delay between ending all interest in Cesc Fabregas and actually bidding for Daniel De Rossi, and then a week before the window closes, they bid £6 million less than the release clause in Ander Herrera's contract, which is just absolutely harebrained. So there were some strange sort of decisions, and Gab's alluded to the Mata deal there. Chelsea and United almost didn't talk to each other in that deal. They had an English representative called Colin Pomford who pretty much brokered the negotiations along with Keir Jarabchin, apparently. But you know, they got the deal over the line, and I think that's all that United fans will care about. I mean, there has been some debate in recent years, can United actually deliver? Can they actually deliver sort of top targets? And Ed Woodward has sort of proved in one sense that he's done that. He's also got Adnan Januzaj to sign a 5-year contract, which I think has been largely overlooked. And I do think that a lot of people might dispute this, but I do think he was following instruction a lot in the summer. And it was just a difficult summer for all of them. I think they hold their hands up, they say they made mistakes, you know, they wish it had gone differently. The key now, though, is it does put a lot of pressure on this summer, and they have to get this right, because they, for whatever reasons, they are in a situation now where they do need to sign four or five players. There is an open acceptance at the club that is very much what they're doing. I think they're talking about 6 in, 10 out in 12 months. So it's going to be interesting. But the hope is that it was a baptism of fire for them, and they've learned some very big lessons.
But the interesting thing about the summer with United is that there are great names coming out in terms of people on the shopping list. Help me here, but Pogba, Gundogan,
yeah, Vidal,
Royce, etc. Yeah. You know, great names from within European football. I can't see these players going to United if United aren't in the Champions League.
Why? You know what? Unless, some of those guys, I can't see them going there at all. And some of the names you mentioned, to be perfectly honest, when you said, "Oh, they had Thiago Alcantara signed up," I'm sure that's what United are telling people. Mm. That's not what I understand. Mm. I understand that both Thiago and Cesc, and can I name the intermediary's name? You can ask me afterwards. I don't think he's kind of litigious, so he doesn't like to be named, but the middleman who they spoke to, I think these guys never wanted to come. I mean, Cesc wanted Thiago out so he could be the first sort of backup choice in midfield, and Thiago wanted to go play for Pep at Bayern Munich. They were never realistic targets. I mean, and what would worry me if I was a United fan is that these people seemingly believe, Thiago Alcantara is dying to come here, you know.
I think it was an enormous naivety in what United tried to do in the summer, and were surprised that deals didn't happen. I don't think many journalists and many fans were surprised that those deals didn't happen. I doubt the players were either. And if they're talking about this summer trying to sign that calibre of player that I mentioned, Mangala from Porto, he's another target. Any time that United are in a bidding war with City, Paris Saint-Germain, Real Madrid, Barcelona, Bayern Munich, they're going to lose, unless they do exactly what Paris Saint-Germain have done the last few years, exactly what Man City did when they signed Touré and Silva and players like that, by throwing enormous amounts of money. And if United aren't in the Champions League, they're not in a position to.
But the counterpoint to that, and you mentioned two of the names, is after City lost to Tottenham in 2009 and missed out on the Champions League, that summer they did go and sign David Silva, Yaya Touré and Mario Balotelli, and at that time particularly they didn't have anything like the sort of the lustre that United do. So yes, it will take money, but City, their sort of inferior neighbours, so to speak, have proven that it is still possible.
Inferior at the moment, were they?
No, I mean, but at that time in 2009, obviously they were still sort of, and you know United's, you know, rear view mirror. So
it may be relevant in that too, that just Yaya Touré was somebody who was probably, as we know, wrongly let go by Barcelona, but who was absolutely slaughtered by the press when he arrived because of the size of his wages, and because I heard people describe him as an old man and he was slow and whatever, and kind of shows you how you probably shouldn't judge people on first impressions. And David Silva, also coming from Valencia, a club that was on the verge of bankruptcy at the time. It's a bit different when you chase targets, I think, at Barcelona. But there's a big kind of elephant in the room, certainly for me, which is that I'm a huge fan of David Moyes. I've had the privilege of spending time with him on several occasions when he was at Everton. And I think I'm just warmly predisposed towards him. But I cannot escape the fact that, and James alluded to it there, that when people say that this United squad is rubbish, that they need to get 10 players out, 6 guys in, or whatever the opposite is, I'm not buying it. And not just because last season they won the title with 89 points, and to that they've added Fellaini and they've added Januzaj, but simply because I expected a lot more. And I think these are very good players that they still have. They still have some very good players. It's not like all these guys became rubbish overnight. I just want to get a show of hands, and this, and everybody can join in this, not just United fans, but please try to be objective. Who here thinks that this squad, this season, is worse than last year? Right, I'd say maybe 15%, something like that. I'd love to know why. We'll get to that, but I want to get Andy's view. Do you think that there's... If you were David Moyes' boss, if you were Mr. Woodward, and he came to you and says, boss, I need to get rid of these guys. They're just not good enough. They're playing with me. Would you hardline him and say, hey, you know what? They were good enough for Sir Alex. And on top of that, you've got all these young players there, Kagawa, Jones, Smalling, Cleverley. Sir Alex thought they were good enough. Sir Alex spent a lot of money to buy these players. Why don't you go and keep developing them and make them better? Would you take that line, or would you say, you know what, Dave, I know what you mean. Sir Alex was a freak of nature. He was incredible. You're very good, but not Sir Alex. Here's a lot of money, go buy players. What would you do?
Well, I wouldn't say over the past 2 years. If you look at Manchester United over, what, the past 4 or 5 years, they've always been there or thereabouts. They've always competed. And if you look at the players that the previous manager added, you know, over the past 2 or 3 years, he's only added like one or two. Before that, Ashley Young, Phil Jones, Smalling come in, and last season, Kagawa and players like that. And I get asked this question all the time. I turn around and say, well, I'll play in that team. Not a problem to me. Because no. I lost it 1 year
no.
by goal difference. Yeah, for sure. Well, if you lose it 1 year on goal difference, that means you're a good team. Mm. If you win it the season after by, what, 11 points, that means you're an even better team. That's what it looks like to me.
And you're so, what, 40, and you could get in this team?
I'm just kidding, you know. I'd love to play because I think people have been trying to knock this Manchester United team for some time. Not just this year, last year, the year before that, been saying, oh, it's not a Manchester United team of this generation or whatever it may be. But if you end up being the best team after 38 games, you're the best team. It's as simple as that. So if this Man United team is not as good as it's been previous years, what does it say about the rest of the teams who have spent absolute fortunes to try and compete with Manchester United?
And you're beating them by what, 12 points?
Well, there you go. Yeah. And then, like I said, the season before, you lose it by a goal difference. So I, my general thoughts are on this team. I think this team is a very good team. It's a very good team. Yeah, people might say it's not as good as that team or that team, but hey, we've all got opinions.
Right.
But they compete every single year to try and win the Premiership in Europe. Unfortunate, very unfortunate last season in Europe, took out to Real Madrid and a dubious sending off. So it's a team that can get better. Naturally they're going to bring more players, but I do believe it's a team that can get better. You've got younger players coming through, which is very important for Manchester United. You've got to bring young players for Manchester United.
Are you satisfied with the way they've been developing? Were you expecting, I mean, look, when you were Smalling's age, you scored a bazillion goals, and I believe you were on the verge of moving to Newcastle for a record amount. Is that right?
Yeah.
Okay. So this guy's been an England international. Phil Jones as well. They moved for a lot of money. Are they where they were? You expect them to be in the development? In their
career?
Well,
you got to be brutally honest. You got to be brutally honest. You're not going to be able to bring through 5 or 6 players, i.e., Beckham, Scholes, but Neville's, you're not going to be able to do that every 2 years, every 3 years. I mean, so you try and bring in younger players what you believe are going to be good enough. Phil Jones, I think Phil Jones is a very good player. You know, I think when Phil buttons down his position that he's going to play, I think he'd be a very good centre half.
But you're speaking in the future. Is he now where you think he should be?
In what position?
That's the problem, right?
In what position?
In a different position.
I do honestly believe he will become a very good centre half.
Right.
You know, I think he's got a bit of a Phil Neville in him at the moment, where he can play numerous positions, you know. And I think once he buttons down his one position, he'd be a very good centre half. Smalling, again, he plays fullback, he plays centre half. I think when you're at that age, if you can try and button down your one position, you know, and can focus on that, of course you're going to improve, and of course you can become better players.
Do you think? I mean, one of the things I think is quite interesting is that the young players now, I would say, have, you know, they would naturally want to look to sort of players above them, and in that sort of 26, 27 to 29
year age bracket, I would say there is a vacuum at the club at the moment. When Beckham, Giggs, Scholes, Neville sort of came through, they were looking to Schmeichel, Keane, you know, Ince, you know, obviously.
Yeah,
you know, yeah, so, well, absolutely. And players like that. And at the moment, you know, in that 26, 27 to 29 year bracket, you've got Valencia, Nani, Kagawa, who are all not exactly sort of, don't give you sort of great conviction. I mean, they're wrestling with their own sort of form.
Sorry, I got to jump in here because this issue is going to come up. If Nani doesn't give you great conviction, can I conclude that he gives David Moyes and Ed Woodward great conviction since they gave him a 5-year contract in September and he hardly played before? What's that all about?
I can only.
Do you ask him this?
Yeah,
I mean,
have you asked him? We think.
Because I love Nani.
The indications are we're to preserve transfer value, but that logic doesn't even make any sense. So
because teams aren't willing to spend a lot of money for a guy who's
They're in dialogue to let him go on loan in the final. I mean, it didn't happen, didn't materialise. The expectation is he'll probably go in the summer. So it is an odd one. But back to that point, I do think that clearly the players who came through in 92 were an exceptional group of players, and I'm not comparing the current crop to them, but it would be interesting to see if how the Beckhams and the Giggses and the Scholes' development would have been maybe inhibited or slowed had they had in their 26, 27 to sort of 29 year bracket that sort of group of players sort of guiding them. And the other thing is the bedrock of the defence for the past decade are in the final sort of 6 months of the contract. I mean, Rio had a fantastic season last season, which probably better than anyone could have expected. He's sort of pretty much been put out to pasture now, and Evra's a victim of playing far too much football. I mean, it's just absolutely ludicrous that a guy whose game is, you know, up and down, up and down, up and down at 32 is expecting to do that over 50 games a season. I mean, I think it's remarkable really that he's maintained it to the level he has for so long, and that was obviously unfortunate that they've not been able to get left back in. So my sort of view of those sort of young players is that yes, maybe they need to take, you know, greater responsibility, but I don't think they're being helped by that next sort of bracket.
I was just going to say that this is not an era to be investing huge money or faith in young English players. I mean, it is if you want to fill the boxes of homegrown quotas, etc., and if you want to be seen to be doing it. But Man City are having all their success without young English players. I mean, Joe Hart, yes, but
without young players.
Well,
yeah, for sure.
But
sure.
That under 21 team that had Welbeck, Cleverley, Jones, Smalling. Let's not pretend that was a good generation. Let's not pretend that is comparable to the Beckham Scholes.
What good generation? What English players are you playing for Manchester United or playing for England?
I mean, an English generation. It's not a great generation, I don't think.
But I'd suggest that maybe part of the problem is in the same way they might not be productive to compare people to Sir Alex. Maybe it's probably not productive to compare too many people to that generation of 92.
Yeah, because that's freakish.
They're freaks and outliers.
That's freakish.
You know.
But then, you know, was Nicky Butt an exceptional player? Was Phil, I mean, in talent terms, was Phil Neville exceptional in talent terms? Was Gary Neville exceptional in talent terms? You know, they all had something about them. I mean, which is a much broader subject, but they all had something about them which.
But in saying that, do you have to be exceptional for people to look at you and say you're a top player?
Mm. No. But I'm just saying they had something about them mentally or whatever, or maybe that sort of growing up together.
It's a winning mentality is what it is.
And maybe it's easier to have a winning mentality when you play surrounded by great players like Roy Keane and Schmeichel than it is by surrounded by some of the guys they're surrounded with. Now, the man with the lumberjack shirt in the back of the room is signaling to me that I need to end the United portion of the discussion. Just for now, we will have a full and comprehensive Q&A. And for the benefit of the two City fans in attendance tonight, all the other ones are down the road at the Guardian, have a City discussion. So, United fans, you know, this is your chance to put City down. How many people here hate Manchester City? All right, there you go. There you go. That's a good one, 25%. Andy didn't raise his hand, but
I'm just going to say hate is a strong word. It's a strong word.
But one of the big things, obviously, with Manchester City, it's I think it's difficult to ignore is that this is a story of a club that all of a sudden found itself with nearly limitless access to money. And I think, James, I mean, I know you've written a lot about this. They've not just gone out and bought players. They've tried to be a community club. They've been very aware of that. They won all sorts of awards for this. I don't live in Manchester. You guys all do. Even United fans, I just want to show of hands, do you think that City have generally tried to be good corporate citizens for the city and try to be objective? All right, that's 20, 25%. Would you 30, 35 even? James, they're doing this for a reason, aren't they?
Yeah, I mean...
They don't just want to be somebody's plaything.
No, I mean, Abu Dhabi is all about success. I mean, they sort of live and breathe. They want success. They don't tolerate failure. They're very, very clear about that. But they feel that to be successful over a long period of time, it's best to invest from top to bottom. Be sort of fully committed, be as transparent as possible. And they've done that. I mean, I think what they have done for City has been nothing short of exceptional. It's been a remarkable, and people will lambast them for chucking loads of money at it and upsetting the wage structures and all this sort of things. But I think that generally tends to be disillusioned, disaffected fans from other clubs. The what they have put back into the community, what they are building there, what they're trying to put in place, is very impressive. Now, it might not work. It's fine having all this infrastructure, all these facilities, all these great coaches. They're still going to have to unearth the players, and they only need to look across the road to know how difficult that is. I mean, what if you had Fletcher, Richardson, O'Shea, Cleverley, Welbeck in sort of 20 odd years since the class of 92 came through? And that's for a club who had a huge head start on virtually anyone else. So this sudden idea that they're going to be able to unearth a Champions League quality player every two seasons is probably far-fetched. But, you know, it's no quick fix. I mean, Chelsea are trying to make sort of changes now, but I think City came with a very, very clear vision from the start, and I think it is a good contrast. Where it takes them, we'll have to see.
Andy, one of the things that, from the perspective of the fans, somebody who's never had the opportunity to play professionally, what's often difficult to understand is when people make decisions based on money versus the chance to win things versus the chance to win things as a starter on the pitch. I know, obviously, from your own experience, when maybe you weren't a first-choice regular anymore at United, you said, rather than being a passenger here and getting a whole bunch of medals because, you know, I'd rather go and play somewhere else. Is this something that footballers struggle with from what you've seen? And I'm just thinking about players who've been perhaps moved to City, gotten huge pay rises, have won things, but didn't really get a chance to get on the pitch.
I think that's down to the individual. Football's changed a hell of a lot. And if you notice now, there could be a lot of players that are not in the first team and not signed a new 4-year contract, and you turn and say, well, you only play like 15 games a season at most. So some say, well, I'm prepared to stay and pick up a nice paycheck at the end of the month and get 15 games, and if we win the league, I've got another medal and all that. But I think that's all down to the individual. And if you look at the Man City team now, Pellegrini's gone there, taken the shackles off, and he's played a team that he believes is going to win. Now, the English boys are not playing. Lescott, Milner, Rodwell.
Richards.
Because he's looking at that and saying to himself, this is my best team, and I'm going to play them week in, week out. And regardless of what anyone else thinks, I'm going to keep playing them. And that's how you get there in the end.
Not playing English players.
No, I'm not saying not playing English players, but if you look at these guys, just like the other day, he plays Chelsea, he plays the centre half in centre midfield. You turn around and say to yourself, well, can James Milner not play there? Can Rodwell not play there?
They weren't fully fit, though. He was saying they weren't.
I tell you what, if they're not fully fit, I would have a central midfield player play central midfield. then I know he's played midfield numerous times for Bayern or whatever, but he said in the end, I don't want to play central midfield. If someone doesn't want to play central midfield, you play someone who's not 100% fit.
I agree wholeheartedly with him. That was their explanation for it.
Ollie, there's also a factor here that people focus on that, but those four players that Andy just cited, to be fair, except for Milner, they didn't play very much under the previous manager.
No.
And I think I'm right in saying every single one of those guys, except for Rodwell, was bought actually two men.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number smart beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on the Sleep Number limited edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
Rising sea levels, extreme weather patterns, extinctions of species. Our planet needs protecting. I'm Adam Vaughan, the environment editor for The Times, and this is Planet Hope from The Times, in partnership with Rolex and its Perpetual Planet Initiative. In this podcast, we hear from leading experts from around the world who are committed to finding solutions. These explorers, scientists, entrepreneurs, and citizens are committed to a common goal: to protect our home, Earth. Listen now wherever you get your podcasts.
Years ago, and these are people who came, signed enormous contracts, because when you sign a big contract, you know, you basically have to take a pay cut to go elsewhere, or you have like a Gareth Barry situation where they just kind of, you know, let you go, and he's done it, and he's done very well as a result, obviously, at Everton. Does that come into it too, that, you know, as Andy said, Pellegrini wants to play his best team? These are dudes he inherited who the club can't really get rid of, and gives them a chance of training, but ultimately he's going to want to stick with his guys.
Well, so speaking to people at Manchester City, you ask about Rodwell, you say, well, will Rodwell go when Javi Garcia comes in, when Fernandinho comes in, when Fernando probably comes in the summer from Porto? And they tell you, well, there's the homegrown thing. He's a homegrown player. He fills a slot. And there's an advantage to have. I mean, City have to have eight homegrown players, and they include a 36-year-old third choice keeper, which is Richard Wright. They include, help me here, Dedric Boyata, who's not even English, Gael Clichy, who's not English, Rodwell, Richards, Milner, Hart. I think this is it. Yeah. So they have to have English players, and they have to keep English players. And Rodwell went there really on a false promise. You could say he's not really kicked on, and I think that would be fair. I don't think he even really kicked on at Everton the way most of us probably hoped
he's never been fit, neither has Michael Richards.
But he was signed to be sort of fourth choice central midfielder, and he ticked a box because he was English. And I mean, when you look at that homegrown rule, that is exactly what it wasn't meant to do.
It was meant to get English players playing.
I mean, I'm going off on a broader issue, and shut me up, but it's, you know, that rule isn't healthy. I remember there was a game England played in Switzerland 2010, it was just after the World Cup, and there were about six or seven City players on the pitch by the end: Adam Johnson, Lescott, Barry, Hart, Milner, Richards, probably six. And I think City fans were quite proud of that. But I think they're more proud of having a team that, of mostly foreign players,
that win,
and have got a great chance of going to Barcelona next, you know, in a couple of weeks, and getting a result. I mean, it would be utopia, really, if they had what United had back in 1999, which was a European Cup winning team full of Mancunian players, or half full of Mancunian players. But I think times have changed. I think it's very, very difficult to do that. And if City are trying to get English players in their team, I think it's really difficult, because they are improving far more than English players are improving. You know, the bar there is set so high that it's going to be very difficult for any English player to get in the team unless they buy Wilshere or Barkley or something like that. And would they get in the team?
Of course it's going to be difficult, because ultimately however you look at it, you've got to buy your success.
Yeah.
So you buy your success, you don't care where he's from in the world. If he can come to this football club, if he can make it better, we're going to buy him. And they've got no time to wait for the English players. And when you're putting that amount of money into a project, why should you wait for the English players?
No.
Because like you just touched on there, in Abu Dhabi, the winners, they want to win, they want it now. Tomorrow's not good enough, we want it today. And, and that's the way it's going to be. But in saying that, that was Chelsea's blueprint when Abramovich took over. I know he brought a lot of English players to try and bring the academy through. But if you look at their academy, you turn around and say, so what players actually come through Chelsea's academy since Abramovich has come and said, we're going to buy the English players and bring them through and bring them into the first team? No one's prepared to do that because they need a success now.
A few on the back of this, I can reveal this now, I wouldn't mind, but about 18 months ago, I spoke to somebody at a mid-table club who was very keen on an English Manchester United player who cost a fair bit of money, wasn't playing every week, and he really wanted to play every week, and it was more important to him to play every week than to be at Manchester United. But he just made too much money. He was like a slave to his contract because he would have had to take, for this club to afford him, they were willing to give him a much longer deal, but he would have had to, incentive laden and so on. And in the end, he said, I'm scared that in 20 years I might go bankrupt if I don't do this, and I'm worried about my future. And it's difficult for people to understand when, you read about footballers' wages in the papers and stuff about how this could happen. I'm wondering, is there an issue there as well that these guys at City that we talk about, they're at City, so they've most of them cost quite a bit of money. They're all on good wages, and it's other clubs simply cannot afford them.
Yeah, like I say we're all different individuals. I can only talk from my experience. One of the reasons I left Manchester United was I wanted to play.
Right.
I wanted to play week in, week out. I got to 30 and...
And you'd already won your treble, so...
I won, but I still wanted to win, and I still wanted to turn out on Saturday, Wednesday, Saturday, Wednesday. You get to 30 and people start saying, he's getting on in age. I said, well, I can start at Man United, and I love Man United. Man United's my football club, and I can sit here, I had 3 years left on my contract, and pick my money up and say, oh, fantastic, brilliant, beautiful. No. No, that's not me. I wanted people to look at me and say, he's gone out there today, he's worked his socks off and he's earned his money. Now, I'm not saying everyone's going to be like me. I had the same chat yesterday with Robbie Fowler. Robbie Fowler said one of the reasons he left Liverpool, Julio wasn't playing, he could have stayed at Liverpool. He said, so I want to play. So you're going to have quite a few players that actually want to play regardless of the money, just want to play football, or you're going to have a few players that say, well, life's good.
Did you regress it after a few months under Graham Souness, though?
I found it tough. I found it very, very tough, because when you talk about being the height of your profession and a football club that is run so professionally, day in, day out, you travel, your security is this, everything, you know what to do from going into training and seeing that one cone in the middle of the training pitch was being there every single day I was at a football club. It was tough. But then that's when you become a true professional to yourself and say to yourself, right, I've got to get my head down because I'm doing it for me. It's about being a professional.
Something I'm curious about just on the back of this, and soonish we'll go to a break and then we'll have a whole Q&A. But when you played for Manchester United, there might have been games where you didn't play particularly well, perhaps, but then you had teammates who were so good and the assist was goals was perfect and it was right there.
That's when you're playing a good team.
Exactly. Can you just talk a little bit about the dynamic when all of a sudden you're playing with guys who are nowhere near as good? You feel like you need to do more. You don't have four or five superstars, anyone who can rise up on the day and carry you. Does it somehow make it more rewarding in some ways?
It's a bigger challenge for you.
Because you're not a passenger.
Yeah, you can't afford to be a passenger. And you're saying to yourself, right, if you're trying to get the rest of your teammates to get up to your level, which they want to do, because if you've got a lot of young boys in your team, they're looking at you and saying, I want to play for Manchester United in 2 or 3 years. I need to get to that level. And they try to get to that level. to get to where you are. And I took great pleasure out of that. I really did. That so many players want to get to the level, sit down and talk to you about what would you like playing for Man United? Do you have to do this? Do you have to do that? It's a great feeling to know that so many young players want to get to play at the highest level and not to say, well, yeah, I'm here and I just want to play at this level. I think it's a great honour when you do that.
So you're signalling to me, Skinner, does it? This means break? All right, okay. All right, so we're going to take a little intermission, and afterwards, Q&A is basically wide open. You can ask us whatever you like. Perhaps keep the political questions at a minimum. We've cleared it with Andy before. I think you're fair to say you're likely to abstain, yes? So we won't go there. Earlier, I asked you whether you thought this United squad was markedly worse than last year's, or roughly the same. I was asked by, and you can, it's the gentleman here in the second row with the beard. There's more than one, okay. But with the beard, without the glasses.
You asked us whether the team was better this year than it was last year or the same. But I thought a more valid question was, is this a top quality team this year? And, you know, maybe it performed well last year, but that might have been the Ferguson factor. Do people think it is actually a very good top team?
Okay, so show of hands, and I'm assuming you mean in terms of talent, that people look at the table and see that they're in seventh place, and obviously you'd think the six teams ahead of them. But in terms of talent, is this a good United side? All right, so what do you say? Like, what, 25% think this is actually good? Raise my hand too.
It depends what you mean by good. I mean, I don't think United's team last season, as daft as it would sound, was as good as the Premier League table made it look. Man City finished with 78, 79 points, something like that.
Yeah,
Chelsea underachieved again in the league and got 75 or something. Arsenal in transition, Liverpool in transition, Spurs under a new manager.
Can I ask you a question? What does transition actually mean?
it's what United are now. Teams go kind of up and down, and you know when a team is emerging from a spell and it's ready to be competitive again. And I think United have had this remarkable knack over the past 20 years of being in transition, like in 95-96, and winning stuff. Arsenal have been in transition and improving and then up and down and not winning stuff. And it's, I think transition is a real concept. But
yeah, so how long does it take to actually come out of transition? Because you just mentioned Arsenal have been up and down. So are they still in transition now? You mentioned Chelsea.
I'd say Arsenal have reached a period of stability where they're able to sort of improve now, because there's been less comings and goings, and they haven't lost their best player like they have done. But it becomes transition.
I mean, that's the ultimate discriminant, right? Is there are certain teams who, because they're big clubs, never or almost never lose a player against the manager's wishes. I'm thinking of Manchester United, and Sir Alex may deny this, but I think he probably might have been happy to keep Paul Ince. But that's maybe the last guy they lost.
Ronaldo.
Oh, yeah, sorry. That Ronaldo guy was pretty good, yeah.
Bebe.
Bebe, yeah. But, you know, you're talking from Cristiano back to Ince, you know, you're going back.
Paul Pogba.
Sorry?
Paul Pogba.
Yeah, I'm talking about players who actually contributed to the first 11. But in terms of, you know, that's more than 20 years. If you look at Arsenal, you know, it's Nasri, it's Sesk, it's Van Persie.
But like I said, that's by choice.
It's not by choice. They wanted to keep these guys.
So, okay.
Guys left.
So you want to keep these guys now. How do you keep your top players from going to one of your top rivals? You buy better players to make your team better, to win championship, and then your players stay. Now, okay. Robin Van Persie ends up leaving Arsenal for what reason?
Because he didn't get a contract.
Now, if Arsenal buy better players so Robin Van Persie can play in a better team and also win the league, would Robin Van Persie say, well, I'm going to leave now?
Right, but to be fair, I'd say that applies to Arsenal because we all know that they're sitting on a giant wad of cash. For most clubs, how many people here support a team that's outside the top six? There you go. So it's not a...
No, no, come on. These are just the United fans again.
What? There you go. There's a gentleman, Sir Ollie Kaye. But you take my point here is you can be a team that's outside that and you can try to build and you develop young players and you have them, but then all of a sudden you lose your star and then you're transitioning again. And I agree with you. Arsenal don't have that excuse, but for most teams, they have that. Because United come along and be like, all right, Phil Jones?
It's by choice. For me personally, any top team that sells one of their top players, that's by their choice. Because I can't be, if I'm a top team, I can't be selling my best player to the team that I know can pick me to the championship. And all he wants is from a manager to say, I'm going to bring in XYZ and bring in XYZ to make us better so we can compete. You can't be sitting on cash if you're not competing. That's like Nasri. Did Nasri say, I want to leave Arsenal because I'm going to Man City because Man City are going to finish lower than Arsenal?
Well, they'll pay me a lot more money too in Nasri's case. But yeah.
But as they say, if you win, you're going to make money anyway.
Now, we're going to throw it to questions. And as I said, just about anything is fair game. That's Jerome in the back. Spells his name. His last name with a Y, but Jerome, just raise your hand. They'll come to you with the microphone so we can all hear it. Yes, the.
Hi, my name is Mike Curry.
I don't support Man United or Manchester City. I found myself feeling sympathy for David Moyes when I heard the panel's comments earlier. Oliver started off by saying that he should be his own man when it comes to Manchester United. But latterly, he said that really it was an impossible job to follow Alex Ferguson. And nowadays you need to be a diplomat when you take over from somebody like Alex Ferguson. But if you change the name slightly and say, instead of Alex Ferguson, talk about Don Revie, and instead of Mourinho, talk about Brian Clough, you can see what happened when somebody came and wanted to be the old man. It was a disaster. Mm. And I think it might have been the same at Manchester United. He didn't last very long, did he, at Leeds United all those years ago?
So your implication is that you cannot replace...
You can't replace somebody who's been there 26 years just like that. You've got to tread carefully. And I think that's what David Moyes has felt. And we talk about transitions, it's a transition.
Right.
And I don't think anybody expected Man United to carry on and win the league by 11 points again with Alex Ferguson leaving.
Mm. There's no Liverpool fans in this panel, but I'm sure somebody can tell me how many years Shankly was there.
14.
Right. And the guy who replaced him did pretty well?
He did, but then the difference with Shankly to Paisley was it was internal. It was very much a kind of continuation. I think United looked at that and thought, let's kind of do that same evolution thing, but they didn't have anyone internal. They couldn't turn to Mike Phelan to do the job.
Brian McClair?
Carlos Queiroz had gone. Well, I don't think any of those guys, because Ferguson was so domineering, I don't think any of those guys had really built up that level of authority within the club. And I think they went for... Ferguson went for Moyes because he viewed him as the closest thing to a sort of continuity candidate.
But then was he a continuity candidate? Because obviously one of the controversial things, were you guys on this, he changed the backroom staff. I mean, I hear from United fans who follow closely that all of a sudden he got rid of those guys and he brought in a bunch of, I'm quoting here from somebody who tweeted me earlier today, a bunch of losers who'd never won anything from Everton.
Phil Neville won stuff.
Not as a coach.
No. I mean
does that matter?
It's a slight misconception because he absolutely wanted Rennie Mullenstein to stay, and there is some dispute about, I mean, Mullenstein says he wasn't offered the assistant's job. Moyes claims he was offered the assistant's job, so there's some dispute there.
So he
after
did.
After four year relegated, will he still?
No, look. So some coaches should never be managers or whatever. But Mullenstein was a good first team coach. He's very, very, very well respected first team coach. So there was an attempt there. So I think some of the criticism Moyes has got for sort of changing the backroom staff, it's like it's almost been construed as if he came in there and thought, sod this, out with you lot. I'm bringing in every single sort of new member that I want, and it wasn't quite like that really. So I think that's a little bit harsh on him.
And you know some of these guys who left when Sir Alex left. You would have worked under them. Do you think it would have been viable for them to stay? Do you think?
Oh, well, if you're, well, of course you look at it and say you'd love them to stay, you know, because Manchester United is a machine, you know, and one leaves, you'd like want to stay and basically see it through, and continuity in football is massive. So you look like Ryan Giggs has stepped up to a coaching capacity now, as well as still playing. You look at that and say that's a great move, because he knows what Manchester United is all about, you know. And you spoke about David Moyes, you know, looking at senior players and saying, right, I've got to take my lead off those. He looks at Ryan Giggs, and that's where you take your lead off people like that. So it would be nice to have definitely have backroom staff around who've been there, done it, gone through the tough times as well as the good times, and now turn things around.
Good evening, guys. My name's Paul Hughes. I'm a Liverpool fan, so it's probably just me and a few others here, perhaps just one.
There's one other here in the front row.
Oh,
several, there you go.
Show of hands. There's more than City fans. Obviously, there's been a lot of talk about whether United are a better team or a worse team than last year, and whether, in fact, they're even a good team. I obviously have an interest in this because Liverpool have definitely pushed on, but are they the most improved team in the top four, or are City, Arsenal and Chelsea just as improved? I'd like the panel's views on that, if possible.
On to very quickly for my part, I think City are far improved. I think Chelsea are a better side right now as well. Very briefly, anybody want to...
No, I'd agree with that, and I think Arsenal are much improved, and as you say, Liverpool are vastly improved. You look at Liverpool's points over the last three seasons, they've been a sort of, you know, I'd be plucking numbers off the top of my head, but they've been a, you know, seventh, eighth team over the last few years, and their form is now that of a very good top four team. And for United to catch them now, it looks like it will take United to improve massively and Liverpool to dip massively, because Liverpool are vastly improved. Everton, you have to say, Everton have improved enormously, and I think that's what people probably didn't expect when Moyes left. But Martinez has sort of compounded this sort of negativity towards Moyes, because he's made Moyes look bad by taking Everton forward as well as he could.
I don't want to pile on to Moyes.
No,
since you mentioned Everton, Ross Barkley, we have a situation now where I read some of you guys in the English media, and it's like, you know, oh, is he the best player, best young player in Europe, blah, blah, blah. And I'm thinking to myself, we saw glimpses of him when he was 18 at Everton, and then it seemed like Moyes wanted no part of him. He loaned him out all over the place. He didn't see him as somebody who was ready to step in any case. Are you surprised by that? Is there a good reason why?
Well, he had that very bad leg injury, leg break, I think it was, and they felt at that time before the injury that he could quite easily be a central midfielder in the sort of classic sense, and also very much a number 10. And after that, they felt that after that injury, they felt it affected him quite terribly, and that it impacted on his ability to do the sort of classic central midfield role. I don't know the extent of the detail of that, but that is obviously that's what's been relayed to me. And that Moyes saw him very much as a number 10 and only a number 10, which is no bad thing. And I think from speaking to Martinez, he views him very much as that role. And I think the difference is that Martinez has entrusted him in a crucial position in a team, and they play that sort of 4-2-3-1 formation that a lot of teams seem to play now, and the number 10 role is absolutely central to everything that sort of happens. And I think the he seemed some players go out on loan, go to the Championship, go to League One, and struggle. And it doesn't mean that they're a bad player. They're just a lot more suited to the top level. I know it sounds a strange thing to say, but some players are just more suited to playing at the at high standard. And I think Barkley has fitted into that. And I think he's embraced the responsibility. He's embraced he's obviously great belief in it, and it's working out for him. But it's very early days. I mean, we're terrible in this country, I know, and we're guilty of this, of jumping on and lauding early praise. But it's promising.
Anyway, I want to give you
the media being honest, man. What's happening there?
Well, you got a lot of attention, obviously, as a young age as well. Is it something that, I mean, what James just described? Is it? Should we kind of pump the brakes a little bit on some of these players?
Should we? Oh, not many. Not many. I just think, you know, we have a talented kid in England and everything gets heaped on him. He's the English Pele. He's going to be the Diego Maradona. He's going to be the best player in the world. And a couple of years down the road, the same people who put him on that pedestal, the same people who are knocking him. Yeah. Same, so let him progress the way he's going to progress. Wishing him that he's going to become a better player and learn the game a lot more than when he, because when you're a kid, you play with everything, you play with edge, you're not under any restrictions, you go out there, you do what you want to do. And then when you start thinking about it a bit more as you get older, that's when your problems come, because you've got to start fitting into a framework and you've got to play with more responsibilities. And it's tough being a good player in England when you're young, because you get everything.
Well, I just see that Adnan Januzaj being nominated for BBC Young Sports Personality of the Year when he started with two games more than all he came for United, I thought was just...
He was the only one I'd heard of on the shortlist.
Exactly. Next question. Jerome, sorry, do you want to perhaps, just to expedite, make sure we get as many questions as possible, when the question's over, just hand it to the next person who wants to ask a question. Yep, all ears.
Hello, my name's Charlotte and I'm an Everton fan. My question is for the panel. We often talk about football in terms of economics, but since we're at the National Football Museum, I wondered what you all thought about football's contribution to heritage and local and national identities and a sense of history.
So was the question in that was... I heard the last bit, but I just didn't actually quite what the question was.
So we talk about football in terms of economics, but what does the panel think about its contribution to heritage and history?
Ollie?
Absolutely enormous and completely underappreciated and underestimated. Because if you think of, you know, what's the most important institution in, for example, Coventry, I mean, I know they have the
cathedral.
They've got a cathedral, but the cathedral's not for everybody, is it?
God,
I know football's not for everybody, but football will always be there. Will religion always? No, football is just. I mean, I've got a huge sort of bee in my bonnet about this at the moment, but about clubs being just treated like dirt. I mean, we've seen Man United are being exploited to a certain extent very, very large extent, but are surviving with the Glazers' ownership. You see utterly cynical ownership creeping in all over the country. You see, I mean, I mentioned Coventry being made to play in Northampton because the hedge fund owners have got a disagreement with the council over ground rent. You see Leeds United, God knows what, you know, they've had 12 years or 13 years of bad ownership and have been going down the pan trying to recover, and more turbulence ahead. And there are so many examples of this. Blackburn, Venky's, it's just, I personally think a sort of preservation order needs to be put out around clubs, because I think they are the most important thing to an awful lot of people.
It's an interesting point, because I mean, one of my favorite quotes actually comes from an ad for Patek Philippe, which is a very expensive watch for those who don't know, but it basically says, like, you know, you could never actually own a football club, you simply look after it for the next generation. And I buy into that. They were talking about it for a fancy Swiss watch, which I don't agree with because I think they're ugly watches. But but in Germany, for example, there's a rule, the so-called 50 plus 1 rule, which some of you may be familiar with, but basically it says that 50% plus one shares of the club have to be on the club members, which is basically anybody can buy a membership. And so a shareholder coming in could only buy up to 49%. One of the side effects of that is that if I'm Sheikh Mansour, for example, or Roman Abramovich, or Mike Ashley, or Martin Edwards, I'm not going to, or actually it was Martin Edwards' dad, right? About Louis Edwards, the butcher. I'm not going to go and buy a football club if I can't go and run it, right? And if I have to go and defer to all you commoners out there. So there's good and bad. And I'd just love to have, see a show of hands here. How many people think that a 50 plus 1 rule, so in other words, a rule that would basically bar a lot of wealthy investors from buying a majority share of the football club, how many think that that would be a good idea? So you guys are with the rich people, you're the oligarchs.
Oh, sorry, am I going to put my hand up?
Well, Ollie's voting, you can vote.
Oh, right, okay.
You don't have to.
I agree with that.
With promotion. Okay, no, it's interesting because it's, I mean, for me personally, I'm all for the process of democracy. It's not a view I personally share. And I don't want to make this just about City and Chelsea, but obviously they're two teams that have become enormous beneficiaries. You could make the point that had a 50% plus one rule been in effect for City, then, you know, Chelsea would be bankrupt right now, probably. Although actually Ken Bates would have never come, so they'd probably be, I don't know, somewhere in the second flight. Stood out there to another question. Or somewhere else.
Hi, I'm Son, I'm a United fan. I'm a United fan. On the game a few weeks ago, there was quite a heated debate about Rooney's contract, mainly from yourself, Gab, saying it was a logical conclusion to give him all the caveats that he wanted. In the emotional element of football as a fan, would you not rather have a player who wanted to play for your club and wanted to be there, good and the bad, rather than hold the club over a barrel every 2 years? If it was your club, what would you want?
I get a little bit cynical about this, players who wants to play for the club. There are players who've taken pay cuts to play for their cuts, for their clubs. But there's not very many of them. I think these people are professionals and they have to do what's best for their career. From United's perspective, I said, I don't think there's a great market for Wayne Rooney out there at the prices that we're seeing and at the wages that he's on. So I think United are playing this correctly. Just sit tight. And you'll get the money, you'll get him to re-sign for, you know, a number that you're comfortable with. Same thing that happened last time when everybody was sure, when he made that statement about Sir Alex and lack of ambition or whatever. The reality is you didn't have Bayern Munich showing up with 50 million saying, we must have Wayne Rooney. It just doesn't happen. And you can give a different perspective on that, perhaps on this whole notion. Obviously fans see you, you're wearing the club shirt, you're a little, you know, why can't you be happy with the, you know, 200 grand a week or whatever.
Why shouldn't you be happy with 200 grand a week? Jesus. Like I was just saying, there's people on 15 grand a year and they're happy, you know. I don't know. Like I said, football, however you look at football, football's it's a business. It's a massive, massive business. It's a short career. And as players, naturally, you want to try and make as much money as you can before you retire. But you got to look at the fans and you got to appreciate where the fans are coming from, because I mean, the fans are always going to support the football teams, as simple as that. So, yeah, you do get despondent if you hear such and such is considering leaving or whatever. Maybe. But I think it always runs its natural course in the end. You know, if someone's going to stay or someone's going to leave, nine times out of ten, there's not many people who want to leave Manchester United. There's loads of shenanigans and all that. But when it comes to actually leaving Manchester United, there's not many who want to go.
All right, the man in the lumberjack shirt says we have to end it. I'm going to overrule him. So I have one more question.
Hi, my name's Ian, Man United fan. I'm interested in the panel's opinion on tactical developments. They always seem to, at the World Cup, there always seems to be a sort of a watermark in players' performances, team shapes, etc. And it was the thinking of Juan Mata being able to defend that got me thinking about it. You know, would you expect a central defender to, who's got signed to be scoring 15 goals a season as much as you would expect Mata to be defending? I'm wondering what the panel's thoughts are on sort of the next tactical development to oppositioning. The other ones that I've seen that haven't got a moniker yet are central defenders and the goalkeeper. You know, what is the next thing that your panel think that might be sort of in the offing?
I asked Roberto Martinez this about 2 years ago, and he was saying, well, we are, this is when he was at Wigan, he said, we're in the process of moving towards what he described as a 3-4-3, which I'd say was fairly successful, even though they got relegated. And he was of the opinion that, you know, I think Napoli were doing it at the time, he was saying that one or other, you know, another of the Italian teams was doing it at the same time. He was of the opinion that there'll be this enormous move towards that over the next couple of years, and that's not happened. But he was also saying that once we do that, we already have to be thinking about what the next step is. And that struck me at the time as being, yeah, very exciting. But I don't really see these things ever.
So is that what Ajax were playing?
What, in mid-90s was, yep, sort of 3-3-1-3 or something.
Yeah. Is that what Barcelona play every week?
You're saying you can't reinvent the wheel, Andy?
Me personally, yeah, of course you can. If you've got the personnel to do it, you look at that Ajax team and you say, yourself, what are they actually doing?
The sort of 70s team or the mid-90s team? Or
70s team and the 90s team. Because you look at those teams, you say to yourself, wow. You know, you look at Barcelona, the way Barcelona started playing out and then just pushed the fullbacks right out the pitch. Yeah. The centre-half was virtually all right up pitching and saying, you play one-on-one now. Mm. Because if you've got the personnel to do it, you're going to do it. Now, 9 times out of 10, a lot of teams don't have the personnel to do it, because Barcelona can do it and Ajax can do it because they kept the ball retention. That's why you can do it. And you believe in your centre-half saying, well, I'll match the centre-forward 1v1 and it'll get on with it. When you've got the players to do it, you can do it. But if you haven't got the players, you can talk about all these systems, but it makes no difference.
I think your point on the centre-half is interesting. I mean, Gab might sort of shoot me down there, and Klopp and Germany might have abandoned it, but I'm sure there was a time spell where Matt Hummels was sort of playing at centre-half, but he was having this sort of free reign to sort of join the midfield and almost the attack at times. And I think even in the City game, when they absolutely wiped the floor with City in the one-all draw in the Champions League, it was a remarkable sort of performance, and he was all over the place. And obviously Dortmund have regressed a little bit, and that might have changed now, and I don't know whether it's quite embraced at Germany, but I thought that might be something that would move on. It doesn't quite seem to have taken off, and maybe that's a reflection that, you know, we're not in a golden age of centre halves at the moment, capable of that.
I think it's a down the head. I think what you said about you don't reinvent anything, but there are certain cyclical things. And I think back to the late 90s, and even in the Premier League, you know, country of Neil Ruddock, I could think of Rio Ferdinand, I could think of young Rio, Frank Leboeuf, Ledley King. You had ball playing central defenders, even the ones who are very good, like the Manjovic, even the ones who could do it, they're generally not asked to do it. Part of it to do the fact that a lot of teams have a deep lying central midfielder, part of it is because so much of the build up play comes via the fullbacks, and it tends to become a bit of a self fulfilling prophecy. I rather expect that maybe the next innovation will be teams now trying to produce ball-playing midfielders again, who maybe have the option of bypassing an ever more congested midfield or coming into midfield. And I think when you talked about Hummels, and by the way, he's not doing that anymore, partly because people have realized that he's actually really, really slow. He's very good, and he really struggles to get up and down, partly obviously because he had that long injury. I think that that's exactly what Klopp was trying to do. Watch this space. I could be totally wrong.
So are you saying they're going to do away from the holding midfield player, go back to midfield players?
You'll have more of an all-rounder. Or you have all-rounder midfielders, and I think there'll be less of this obsession with having numbers in midfield. You can get the numbers from a central defender joining in the attack.
Yeah.
I think there's going to be, you know, the stats whereby fullbacks get the most touches, which was the case for a long time. Most fullbacks today aren't Gary Neville or Branislav Ivanovic types. they're basically people who a generation ago might have been wingers playing at the back. I think that's going to possibly change. With Mourinho, for example, he's got people like to have fullbacks who are primarily defenders. So that's just.
And there aren't many centre forwards like Andy. You know, there aren't many who are what you would call natural goal scorers. There are Ronaldo, Messi scoring billions of goals, but they are not.
If there is, that's why it's such a big premium on them. That's why you'd have four of the top teams fighting out for that one individual, because everyone wants a goal scorer. Everyone wants, I don't know, someone who's prepared to stay 18-6 yard out and just tap the ball in. Arsenal was screaming out for one a few years ago. Brought in Eduardo, that's what his name was, it?
He broke his leg.
And then he broke his leg. And then Arsenal went away from that. And you look at the way Arsenal play, you turn around and say, so if Arsenal had someone who's prepared to stay in the box and score goals, where could I actually have got to?
Actually, it's curious, just to end this on this note, because I was speaking to somebody who's a scout today and telling me you were coming on. And when you mentioned that there is Andy Cole type goal scorers, and I said, if we were to compare him to somebody today, and he said, the top ones, compare you to Falcao in terms of the type of player, would you see yourself in?
Why not? 50 million.
Yeah, that's okay. I didn't know that was coming. Ladies and gentlemen, Andy Cole, please, a big hand. And also, James Ducker, and Ollie Kaye.